Okay, let's get going on our next pioneer. We're looking next at William Farnsworth. He's the 10th of the pioneers that we're looking at in the series of 27 pioneers. And we have a picture of him here. Quite a robust looking man there from those early years. You have a handout on him. And the Lest We Forget periodical issue that we did on him here, volume 3, number 3. Worthy of Honor is the article that we, the lead article about him. It's about his life here. That'll be available online as well. William Farnsworth was born in 1807. Even though he's a hefty-looking guy here, he was 2.5 pounds when he was born. The actual story is that his father wrapped him up and put him in the big coffee pot to keep him warm. He was that small, and they had a big coffee pot, obviously. He was born in Washington, New Hampshire. 6 generations descent from Matthias Farnsworth, who came to the new colony of Plymouth, Massachusetts, in 1663. When was Plymouth first established? Do you remember that date? 1620. So just 43 years after the founding of Plymouth, his grandfather, 6 generations up, Matthias Farnsworth, arrived there. Obviously, the settlement spread out from Plymouth into other parts of New England. And by this time, they're up in this southern, it's actually southwestern New Hampshire, where Washington is, in that area there. At the age of 23, 1830, he marries Sally Mead, a neighbor girl. They built their own home called Happy Hollow on 216 acres beside the Ashuelot River, which is again in southwestern New Hampshire. Flows into the Connecticut River there, one of the tributaries of the Connecticut. Not sure if I pronounced that one correctly. In 1832, 2 years later, when he was 25 years old, his first child, Lucy, was born. She only lived 3 years. And I would recommend that as we go through this now, you start to number his offspring. Okay? Daughter Lucy was born in 1832. Next year, 1833, in the fall, the stars fall. And so he's an eyewitness of the stars falling in the fall of 1833. 1834, he's 27 years old, and his son, John P., is born. I've given in parentheses beside these offspring a little bit more about them and when they actually died as well, so it lets you know how long his children died and what they were involved with. This son trained as a nurse in Battle Creek later on, became a typhoid fever specialist, and died in 1918. 2 years later, at the age of 29, he has another son, Stephen, born. He's a farmer and lived in Washington all of his life. He died in 1915. 1838, now again, let's remember the decade that we're in here. He's having his kids the decade that William Miller is beginning his ministry, right? Preaching the Advent message. So let's just keep that in context. Son Stephen was born, we mentioned, 1838. Age of 31, he has a daughter, Josephine, born. She became a Seventh-day Adventist later, died in 1860. 1839, when he's 32, he has a son, Lucian, born. He died in 1862. How many does that make? How many? 5? Lucy, John, Stephen, Josephine. And, okay. 1, 2, 3, 4. Lucian B is 5, right? Okay. 1841, when he's 34, he has a son, Albert. He was baptized in 1864, and he died in 1865. That same year, 1841, in addition to having a son, he joined a group of 32 neighbors, and they formed the Christian Society of Washington, New Hampshire. So you can see that they're an industrious group that organized themselves. The next year, what does that group do? 1842? when he's 35 years old, they build the Washington, New Hampshire Christian Church. Built it in April, spring of the year. Obviously, after the winter's passed, they put the church up. The story is that William would lead out in the singing. So it looks like he could have been a good singer, right? Hefty guy. By the way, we said he was 2.5 pounds when he was born. Somewhere I read a description of what he was. He was over 200 pounds and over 6 feet tall. Turned out to be a big guy. Don't remember exactly where I read that now. That group at Washington, New Hampshire, most of them became Adventists through the preaching of Elder Joshua Goodwin. The next year, 1843, when he's 36 years old, number 7 is born, right? George W. He died in 1931. That same year, look who shows up in Washington, New Hampshire. Rachel Oaks, a Seventh-day Baptist. She moved to Washington. Again, remember Washington here is the name of a town, not a state or the District of Columbia. She moved to Washington to live with her daughter, Delight, who was the school teacher. What do you think she brought with her? Okay, she's a Seventh-day Baptist. Remember that Seventh-day Baptist thread, because we're going to look at a later pioneer.
Did we have baptism by immersion yet? Maybe she brought that too.
There were various Baptists involved. Oh, okay. But not as many as we'd like to think, because sometimes they ended up being baptized later. We read about Fitch when he was doing his meetings. They were baptizing by immersion. The next year, that's right, his final sickness, Brother Fitch. 1844, now we're down to the year, 1844. He's 37 years old in the year 1844. In March, there's a visiting Methodist / Adventist pastor. Not all Methodists believed in the Advent. But his name was Frederick Wheeler. And during his time there visiting, apparently it was more than just one weekend, he's preaching on the Advent and preaching on the importance of keeping the commandments. And as the story was, Rachel went up to him afterwards and said, "Brother,
what about
you're preaching about the importance of keeping the commandments. Why are you breaking one?" He preaches his first Seventh-day Sabbath sermon in March. So in other words, he studied it out and accepted the truth. And that was after being challenged by Rachel Oaks. From April to August, something else is happening. I throw this in because of its relationship to the Sabbath, not its relationship to Washington, New Hampshire, geographically. A man by the name of T.M. Preble learned of and began keeping the Sabbath. Now, T.M. Preble, he is a man that you will find on the CD-ROM. There's material by him, but we do not have a specific issue of our, lest we forget, periodical focused on him. But let me just give you a brief description of him. Here's a picture of him, and it's a little bit of a small picture. As you can see, he's a man with quite a beard in those days. Here's his description. He lived from 1810 to 1907. Thomas Motherwell Preble, T.M. Preble. He was a free will Baptist minister from New Hampshire. So he's from the same state, apparently, that these guys are in. He was disfellowshipped from his church after he accepted the teachings of William Miller. He accepted the Seventh-day Sabbath and later published his views in the Hope of Israel. Okay? And we're going to look here at some more details about that. So here is when he first learns of it, in 44, during that spring to summer, he learns about it and begins keeping it. We know that in October of that year, the disappointment comes, the time passes. And the next year, according to William Farnsworth's son, William begins keeping the Sabbath just after New Year's in 1845. In other words, Frederick Wheeler preached on it in March the year before. March of the year 1844, Frederick Wheeler preached in that Washington, Hampshire church on the Seventh-day Sabbath. And so these people obviously are processing it. They may be focused mostly on the time of Christ's coming, but they're processing the Sabbath. And finally, William takes his stand just after New Year's in 45. He's the first in his church to announce his conviction and decision to keep the Sabbath, in spite of Rachel being there and Frederick preaching on it the previous year. A small group then follow him. So what does he turn out to be? He's like the lay leader in his church. He's the first one to take a stand, and then others decide, we'll go with you. And they separate from the first day Adventist, and they begin meeting in family homes. This body of Sabbath-keeping Adventists were the first body of Sabbath-keeping Adventists in existence. That's why we look to that group as the first, what turned into Seventh-day Adventists, right?
And that was in...
This was the first part of 45, okay? Now, let's watch what happens with this, because they withdrew from that church building. The First Day Adventists kept the church building, and they started meeting in people's homes, and they met in people's homes for some time, as we'll see here. February and March of that year, Preble published his views in the Hope of Israel, February 22, and March as a tract, and the tract was called A Tract Showing That the Seventh Day Should Be Observed as the Sabbath Instead of the First Day, According to the Commandment. That tract is on the CD-ROM, as I mentioned. This tract was instrumental for Joseph Bates and J.N. Andrews in their acceptance of the Sabbath. So this is Preble's position, his contribution. Free Will Baptist ministry, convinced on the Sabbath, writes about it. His tract then influences Bates and Andrews to accept it. Okay? Bates visits Washington, New Hampshire that year of 1845, and he finds Farnsworth and these others keeping the Sabbath. In fact, they started a few weeks before he did. So this is how I understand it happened. Rachel Oaks, Seventh-day Baptist, gives the Sabbath truth to this group of believers there in Washington. Frederick Wheeler preaches on it, but he's just a traveling minister. He doesn't stay there. Okay? That congregation remains a first-day keeping Adventist group until Farnsworth, January of the next year, takes a stand on the Sabbath, and a group join him and leave the church and become Sabbath keepers. At the same time, Preble is writing on the Sabbath, learning about it and keeping it himself and writing about it, and his tract comes into the hands of Bates and Andrews. And somehow Bates hears about this group up in Washington, New Hampshire, and he goes up there and he finds they're keeping the Sabbath too. They've got it, one got it from the Seventh-day Baptist, and the other got it from whoever Preble got it from. I don't remember exactly the story as to where he got it from.
Well, they sure were Bereans.
They were Bereans.
And Jan Andrews got it, actually, somebody gave Marion Stoll, a teenager, the booklet, and she shared it with her brother, Lewis Oswald Stoll.
Okay.
And they kept one Sabbath by themselves, and then they shared it with Jan Andrews.
Okay.
And he decided to go with them, and then they decided they needed to share it with the parents.
Okay. So the children of the Stoles family first had it and then gave it to Andrews, and then they shared it with the parents of both the Stoles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I'm kind of related to the Stoles.
Okay.
And so I've noticed
the connection of the Stoles. That's very good.
And the Andrews family were helping the Stoles. I think the Stoles had given up their farm or something,
Okay.
So it ended with those two families then started keeping the Sabbath in their house.
The Stoll and the Andrews family started keeping the Sabbath in their home. Okay,
now,
very good.
This is 45.
45.
You got the Sabbath.
Yes.
Down their gullets. All right.
Yes.
And this is one of the big reasons the Lord couldn't come in 44. They didn't have that.
Right.
All the devil would have to do is say, what about this? Mm-hmm. And their faith would be shattered.
Yeah, it was clear the Sabbath truth was missing from the 44 movement. And we'll find again, I mentioned it earlier, I think, briefly, and as we go to one of the future pioneers, we'll find that whole family experience was wrapped up in the fact that it was missing in the 44 movement.
But they couldn't be the virgins without guile.
Right, the virgins without guile had to be those that had the Sabbath truth and all the other truths that were missing there too. Moving on to the year 1846, William is now 39 years old. He has a daughter named Sarah. Number what? 1928, thank you. She listened until the year 1923. In that fall is when James and Ellen White began keeping the Sabbath. Okay? So this is, again, just throwing these in because we're looking here at William's story, which is wrapped up so much with the Sabbath. I'm throwing in some other things here. I'm not saying there's any direct connection at that point between James and Ellen and William Farnsworth, but we'll see shortly there will be. 1847. He's 40 years old. He has a son, Eugene, born. Child number 9.
He has Eugene, bad luck with children, doesn't he?
Eugene becomes a Seventh-day Adventist minister, conference president, missionary to Australia. He dies in 1935. And interestingly enough, I found on the internet, through the GC Archives website, there's a Symposium of Pioneers article recorded at the 1926 General Conference session in the Review and Herald. And here's E.W. Farnsworth. I was born in Washington, Sullivan County, Newark, New Hampshire in 1847. Okay? I will be 79 years old my next birthday in November, so you'll see I will soon turn the 80th corner. My father began to keep the Sabbath just after the New Year's in 1845. He was the first Adventist man to begin the observance of the Sabbath. Anyway, very interesting that this son of William's here, William Farnsworth, is telling his story in 1926. And I have some extracts, references to that. In fact, that's the article I have referenced in the footnotes, various points here. Also, that year, in April the 7th, the year that William is 40, Ellen White has a vision. And it's a vision regarding the fourth commandment. And here's the way she describes it in the book Life Sketches, page 100. In the ark, describing what she was shown in the vision. This is just one paragraph extracted from the vision. In the ark was the golden pot of manna, Aaron's rod that budded, and the tables of stone, which folded together like a book. Jesus opened them, and I saw the Ten Commandments were written on them with the finger of God. On one table were four, and on the other six. The four on the first table shone brighter than the other six. But the fourth, the Sabbath commandment, shone above them all. For the Sabbath was set apart to be kept in honor of God's holy name. The Holy Sabbath looked glorious. A halo of glory was all around it. I saw that the Sabbath commandment was not nailed to the cross. If it was, the other nine commandments were. And we are at liberty to break them all, as well as to break the fourth. I saw that God had not changed the Sabbath, for he never changes. But the Pope had changed it from the seventh to the first day of the week, for he was to change times and laws. Right. Moving on with our friend William, 1849. 2 years later, he is now 42. A son, Augustus, was born. He was baptized young, became a farmer, and died in 1937. He is number 10. 2 years later, he's 44 years old. He has a daughter, Imogene. She marries a Methodist and joins his church, and she dies in 1913. Number 11. 4 years later, 1855, at the age of 48, his wife, Sally, after a 10-hour illness, dies suddenly on June 30th, leaving 11 children.
Did they used to have 11 children in those years?
Yes, big families. But this was unusual, perhaps, in terms of how many. Obviously, by the time she died in 1855, her daughter, Lucy, was 23 years old. So she had a grown daughter by the time she died. I'm sorry. You're right. I stand corrected. Lucy did not live that long. But she had a son, John, who was 21 years old.
When she died, her oldest child, her youngest child at that time was 4 years old.
Right. Right. So she had some young children. And because of that, what does William do? He remarries very quickly. September of that year, he's remarried to a 25-year-old young lady, Cynthia Stoll.
And she was 48.
He's 48 and she's 25. Yeah, so there's 23 years different. Right. Just a few more years than Ellen White's own son and his second wife, if you look at Willie and May, was it?
And both her sons had a wife that died. But Edson didn't have any children.
Right. 1857, 2 years later, William's 50. He has a daughter, Loretta. She becomes the first female SDA Bible instructor. Marries a minister, A. Robinson. Works in Africa and Australia. She dies in 1933. So, his first child from his second wife becomes the first female Bible instructor. 1859, 2 years later, he's 52. He has a son, Orville. He becomes a missionary to Ireland and England. Dies in 1947. 1860, I've stopped numbering them here. Let's start renumbering them here. That's number 12, 13. We're up to 14. Now, 1860, age 53, daughter Lenora was born. She was baptized later, and she died in 1873. 1861, he has two sons. I'm not clear if these were twins. It seems like they probably would be. So this would be 15 and 16, right? Sons Irvin and Benton were born. Irvin is a layman in Oklahoma, raised up churches there, died in 1907. Benton was baptized when a boy, got diphtheria and died in 1885. Age of what? 24. 1862, 55 years of age, the Christian church in Washington officially becomes Seventh-day Adventist with 15 charter members. So finally, the Seventh-day Adventists are back in the church building that he helped to build. Not clear to me at this point what happened to the first-day Adventist believers that were there, but that becomes theirs.
Maybe they died in the wilderness.
Could have. 1865, age of 58, a son, Elmer, is born, who was a minister and a teacher later on, died in 1937, number 17, right? 1867, age 60, son Alton was born, a layman in Canada, died in 1960. Obviously, these people lived quite a long time. He's number 18. That same year, 1867, when our friend William is 60 years old, James and Ellen White and Jan Andrews come to the Washington church. Watch what happens in this experience. And this is an account from Ellen White's biography. Second volume of the biography, page 217 and following. Monday, December 23, they arrived on Friday, the December 20th, okay? They were going to preach there on Sabbath, and they began, I guess, they have some good meetings, they decided to extend their stay a little bit. Monday, December 23, the meeting was held during the daylight hours in the William Farnsworth home. Farnsworth was the man who in 1844 had risen to his feet in the Washington, New Hampshire church, declared that he was going to keep God's Sabbath. According to his son, it was right after New Year's in 45 that he actually took that stand. Others followed him in his decision. Now there was considerable backsliding among the company of believers in the Washington area. So by 1867, again, it became an Adventist, Seventh-day Adventist church 5 years earlier, right? What happens often? Backsliding. Considerable backsliding among the members of the believers in the Washington area. Farnsworth had secretly gone back to the use of tobacco. One of his sons, Eugene, in later years, told the story of that Monday meeting in their home, which commenced in the morning and continued for 5 hours. That morning, Ellen White had the meeting, and she addressed personally one after another of those assembled in the room. Newell Meade and his wife. Now, Meade, remember who William's first wife was? Sally Meade. This is the neighboring family that he married one of the daughters of. This is the Meade family. They were part of the group. Newell Meade and his wife were among the first. Both had suffered great affliction, and as Ellen White spoke to them, she declared that they had been passing through dark waters until the billows had nearly gone over their heads. She assured them that God loved them, and that if they would only trust their ways to Him, He would bring them forth from the furnace of affliction purified. By the way, it becomes clear that Ellen White had had a vision about the Washington, New Hampshire church, and that was why they decided to go by the church to visit. And what is she doing? She's recounting what she was shown about these different people. So, a message of encouragement for the Meads, right?
You notice what the furnace of affliction does.
Yeah, purifies. That's the Lord's purpose of the furnace, is purification. Sitting in the group was 19-year-old Eugene Farnsworth, one of William's 22 children. We're only down to number 18. But here he's saying 22. Well, four more are coming. So he jumped the gun a little bit, according to the dates I have. But Eugene, the guy who we quoted earlier, right? He's 19 years old. He's there in the group. As he heard Ellen White addressing one, then another, with the messages indicating that she had insights others did not have, an idea came to him. He said in his heart, I wish she would tackle my dad. He knew what most others did not know, that his father had slipped back to the use of tobacco. Their farm was quite isolated, and William did his chewing of tobacco on the sly. But Eugene had seen him spit tobacco juice into the snow and quickly scuff it out with the sight of the boot, out of sight with his boot. As these thoughts were forming in Eugene's head, Ellen White turned and addressed William. I saw that this brother is a slave to tobacco. But the worst of the matter is that he's acting the part of a hypocrite, trying to deceive his brethren into thinking that he has discarded it, as he promised to do when he united with the church. As Eugene saw these covered sins dealt with faithfully by Ellen White, he knew he was witnessing a manifestation of the prophetic gift. When she had finished her messages to different ones in the room, and there was an opportunity for a response, one after another stood and acknowledged the truthfulness of the message, and with repentance and confession yielded himself or herself anew to God. Then the parents made confessions to their children. This touched the hearts of the young people who had been watching and listening, and whose hearts were being moved by the messages and invitations, not only of Ellen, but of James White and Andrews. It's an amazing story. I encourage you to read the whole thing. There was a revival at the church. The young people were praying for one another. Those that had not taken a stand, they were in their rooms, their bedrooms, praying with them and pleading with them, and they were giving their hearts to the Lord. It's an amazing story. Volume 2 of the biographies. Pages 218 and thereabouts. Really? A baptism there? Cut a hole in the ice? That's December. Let me just give you another vignette here from Eugene. Gives you a little picture of what's happening in these days. This is his 1926 recollection there at the General Conference session. It actually is his account of that time. I want to tell you a little interesting experience about the first time, as I recollect, that Sister White was ever there. She with her husband came into church Sabbath morning. Elder White preached, but then he sat down and she got up and began to preach. She pointed out a man over here, and she went on and gave him a testimony, and another one here, and another one here. She read life after life like an open book. And from that day to this, I have had the firmest confidence in the spirit of prophecy. That was his experience. 19 years old, according to the account here. But listen to this account with Andrews. After a while, Jan Andrews came to our place, held a few meetings, and went away. A little later, he came back with Brother and Sister White. I want to show you the wisdom that Brother Andrews had. It always impressed me. When I was a young man, I had a great ambition to be a lawyer. I never thought I was going to be a preacher. Remember what he turned out to be? Eugene? SDA Minister, Conference President, Missionary to Australia? Yeah. Okay, so he wanted to be a lawyer. I never thought I was going to be a preacher. In fact, I didn't think I was going to be a preacher until over in the state of Iowa, they put a license into my hands and told me that I must go out and preach. Elder Andrews came. I was out in the field hoeing corn. I looked up and saw him coming. I was rather timid those days, and I never got near enough to a preacher to let him speak to me. When one came to the house, I found my place out in the barn among the cattle and sheep. As Elder Andrews came toward me, he took a hoe off the gate near where I was working, and I said to myself, what in the world will that fellow do now? He came along and began to hoe corn. Boy that I was, I could see he didn't know a thing about hoeing corn. Andrews was a scholar, not a farmer. I don't believe he ever did anything like that. Finally, he said, Eugene, what is your purpose in life? I liked his frank way of speaking, and I said, Elder Andrews, I'm going to be a lawyer. Well, sir, he said, you might do a good deal worse. I want you to think of the wisdom of that reply. If he had said something directly against my plans, my opposition would have been up. But, he continued, what are you going to do before you're a lawyer? Well, I said, I'm going to school. By the way, we had only 3 months schooling in a year. And when I was about 13 years of age, my father kept me out of school. I never went into a schoolhouse after that until I was 21. So you see, my early school days were rather limited. Continuing his comment to Andrews, I'm going to school until I get an education. What will you do then? I'm going to study law. Yes, and what next? He said. Well, I said, I hope I will practice. And what next? I hope to earn some money and get a competency, get a home and have a family. Yes, and what next? I began to grow nervous. I didn't like the way he was crowding me into that corner, for I saw that he was. He said, what next? Well, I said, I suppose I shall grow old like everyone else. He said, what next? Well, I said, I suppose I shall die. And again he said, what next? I tell you, that great good man had driven me to the end of my chain. Those words stuck in my memory. Then with his great blue eyes looking straight through me, he said, my boy, you take hold of something that will help you to span the chasm, something that will land your feet safely on the other side, where you will be safe for eternity. I have honored Elder Andrews all the days of my life. Well, I must go on almost endlessly. The children grew up and went away. The old folks are all dead and not one is left. The children have grown old and they are talking about the old pioneers. I'm not a pioneer. I have to repudiate that because the pioneers were a generation ahead of me. But the children are here. Some of them are here on the rostrum. So he's telling his story there, 1926. He had what did you say?
I think she and Andrews had an uncle.
Oh, really? Andrews had an uncle that was a lawyer? I don't know that part of the story. But I didn't know Andrews had blue eyes. Now I know he had blue eyes. He said his blue eyes looked right through him. Coming back to Eugene's father, William. Okay, let's wrap him up here. Not a whole lot more. This man obviously had his weakness pointed out. That December day there in 1867, slave to tobacco, he got the victory over it. He didn't like what she did to start with, but he finally humbled himself, got the victory over it, stood as a man. 1868, the next year, at the age of 61, he has a son, Melbourne. He started an academy in Canada. He's number what? 19. He died in 1914. 1870, 2 years later, 63 years of old, daughter Nellie's born. She was baptized later, lived in Lincoln, Nebraska, and died in 1949. Number 20. 1872, age of 65, son Ernest is born. He was a local elder in Canada and died in 1973. Wow. So from 72 to 73 is how many years? 101 years that he was when he died. Number 21. And then in 1874, age of 67, a son Merton was born. Merton became a medical doctor, worked in sanitariums, and he died in 1951. He was number 22. Okay? Amazing story, huh?
I didn't think to bring my notebook on all of his children.
You have the notebook on his children, too, huh?
This is on
William himself, yeah.
But I have a whole notebook on the children. We have pictures for all of them, I think, except for just a couple of them.
Really? That's an interesting.
Lucy's one of them. She died too early.
Right. There's a book that was written. See if I can find the reference here. Right. See if I can find where that is. Here it is. It's Mabel Robinson Miller wrote a book in 1959 called William and His 22, Review and Herald. So that recounts that aspect of him. But I wanted to read this thing here, too. Need to wrap up here. Another testimony of his son, Eugene, regarding this man. He obviously, again, two wives, 11 children by each wife. That's how the 22 children. He makes this testimony about his father. Father began the observance of the Sabbath from the study of scriptures. Mother began to keep the Sabbath the same day that father began. An uncle of mine with his wife began the next Sabbath. Very soon there was a company in Washington of some 15 or 18 keeping the Sabbath. Quite a large flock of young people grew up. Would you agree? The families were large. Would you agree? And trusting to my recollection, for I have to go by that almost entirely, not one of those young people ever left the truth, excepting those who married out of the truth. And every one of those who did marry out of the truth gave up the truth. I hope you fathers and mothers and young people will remember that. And this people are not doing very much better than that, average, nowadays. This one thing those simple-minded people endeavor to do, and that was to hold their children in the truth. Out of the young people who grew up in that little church, seven have given their entire lives to positive, aggressive work in the Third Angel's message. Seven out of that little church. Most of them came from one family. Guess who's? For my father had the delightfully large family of 22 children, and he ought to have had at least seven preachers out of them, hadn't he? They didn't quite all go out from his family, but reckoning those that married into the family, the majority of them belonged to it. And so I am glad, and have always been glad, that I belong to a large family of boys and girls. This is his testimony. I pity a poor boy who has no relatives but his father and mother. For I tell you, you let a boy be brought up in a family with 21 brothers and sisters, and he will get a lot of selfish corners knocked off him before he gets to be 21 years old. How many do we have that are just only children? Well, we can't say that that's, God can't work with only children, because all of us know only children, and God has worked with them as well. But again, a farmer who produced a lot of workers for the cause, kept his children in the truth, took a stand for the truth, had his own weaknesses and struggles like we all do, was reproved of them, and by God's power overcame and left a heritage, godly heritage. I would love to see what's happened to the other descendants. There must be quite a few that we could track down these days. But that is for another time, another place. Well, maybe around the Tree of Life for those 1,000 years when we have a chance to review the genealogies really accurately.
Well, I went to school off here with a lady.
Really? Barnsworth lady? Classmate?
No, I'm sorry. She was a librarian.
Librarian? Okay.
At the academy. Mm-hmm. She was a Barnsworth.
Yeah. So we remember Williams Farnsworth for, number one, the Sabbath connection. Washington, New Hampshire, the first location of a body of Sabbath-keeping Adventists. We also honor him for his full quiver, as the Bible said. Blessed is the man whose quiver is full. And the influence that he was able to spread through that means as well.